Dana Carvey. By 93 I'd done 7 years. George Bush had run its course. Wayne's World, Church Lady had all been done. Basically, I thought I'd done as much as I could do. My younger friends, who were right behind me, David Spade, Chris Farley, and Adam Sandler, were bursting with energy. They'd been on the junior varsity 2 or 3 years, and it just seemed like a natural time for them to take over the show. Dennis Miller had left, John Lovitz had left, and Nora Dunn had left. Bonnie and Terry Turner were leaving right around that time. It was a close call because Phil Hartman was still there, but it felt like the right time to go. I just didn't want to stay too long. Very quickly, you feel incredibly old after you leave the show. What happens is that people come in, you're 31, and then all of a sudden you're 40 in the blink of an eye, and then there's a cast member who's 24, looking at you like you're Chevy Chase or Dan Aykroyd, and shaking when they talk to you. And you go, "But I was just the new guy a second ago." I know that Lorne didn't want me to leave, so it was bittersweet that way. He definitely wanted to keep me through the election, which I did until Clinton was sworn in and stuff, and that added a year and a half. I stayed. I definitely felt some sense of loyalty in that sense. I didn't want to leave him in the lurch. I had such a lucky run on that show that it felt like the right time. I still feel that way. I have no regrets. If I'd left after 5 years, I'd have missed out on a lot. But if I'd stayed 2 more years, into 9 years, I don't think it would have been the right move for me. A lot of people stayed a lot less. Martin Short only did 20 shows. I feel bad for those guys. They didn't get to really explore it. Tom Schiller, writer. I left for good in 1993. It happened abruptly and without any human contact between me and Lorne, and it kind of threw me. Suddenly I went to the office, and guys were putting my things in boxes. They said management had asked Lorne to clean house, but Lorne was nowhere to be found when I wanted to ask him why this was happening to me. And yet it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened, in a way, because I should have left 3 years earlier.
Julia Sweeney. I would say my first 2 years, and even up to my third year, were fabulous. And then my last year was just like one of the worst years of my life. I don't know exactly why. I think that Lorne was feeling a pressure to concentrate more on the younger talent, which wasn't even particularly in age, years younger than me. But it was like going from the like Dana, Phil, me sort of emphasis to the Chris Farley, Adam Sandler sort of emphasis. I think I got one sketch out of my whole 4th year. I complained. I think Lorne really liked me a lot, but I could see in his eyes that I wasn't part of the new order. I don't think anyone cared whether I left or I stayed. And then finally I went to him in March. I had such a difficult time. It's like every week I was writing and writing and nothing was getting on, and I hadn't really been the driving comedic force of a sketch until March, when I just went insane and forced Lorne to put on a sketch that I had written for Patrick Stewart. And the sketch went on last, and it did okay. But I could tell that it was sort of a favor to me to shut me up. Overall, I was over. In April, I went and told Lorne that I wanted to quit. My contract was 5 years, and it had only been 4 years, and he would never, ever tell you, "Please don't go." I wasn't looking for him to say that. I knew that even if he felt that way 1,000%, he would never say it. But I knew that he also didn't want me to go, not so much because he wanted me there, but because he didn't want to have the drama of me leaving. Not like it would be that big of a drama, but it almost felt like he just wished I would disappear, and we didn't even have to have the conversations about me leaving. But by then I had so made up my mind. My agents would say, "Don't leave a job till you get another job," and I had saved up like $70,000, which was like to me $1 zillion. And I felt like I would have scrubbed toilets with a toothbrush rather than come back to that show. There was no job I could imagine having to do that would have been more difficult than returning to that show the next year.
Lorne Michaels. Michael Eisner called and said he wanted to make a movie based on her character Pat, and I said I didn't think so. Then Julia came to talk to me. I had the right to stop her because NBC owned the thing, but I said, good luck, and I let her make the movie. And ever since, it's been on my record. They say, Saturday Night Live movies like It's Pat, and she's unpleasant about the show. And I go, what? Well, why, because her life didn't turn out quite the way she wanted? Now it has. She's done a one-woman show, and she has a baby, and she's defeated cancer.
Christine Zander, writer. I got to know Phil even better, and this was after I had moved to L.A. and they had moved to L.A. after we worked together. Phil was a wonderful guy, incredibly generous and good-hearted, but I think he was difficult to get to know. I think maybe with his male friends it was easier, but I don't really feel like I knew him completely. I think he became unhappy, because the last 2 years the new talent started to come in. It got a little bit more cutthroat, because, you know, the old guard wasn't getting written for as much.
David Mandel. The final season for me was really, really exhausting. I started poking around Los Angeles for sitcom writing and got an offer from Seinfeld. If I was 90% sure I was leaving before, knowing I had Seinfeld pushed me to about 140%. Tim Meadows. The worst year, from my perspective, was the year before the big changeover. The last year with Sandler and Farley and Spade and all those guys was, I think, the most fun backstage, but the least fun on camera. We had good times and we enjoyed each other's friendships, but there were too many people. The writers and the cast people didn't gel, you know? I think after doing a certain number of years, it seemed like there were 30 people trying to race to the finish line, instead of people sort of like being a relay team and the writers handing out funny pieces for the performers to do. There were a lot of talented people, and it was weird because when you looked at the people that left during that big changeover, a lot of those people went over to write and produce for The Simpsons and Seinfeld. Sandler and Farley and Spade and Jay Moore and all these talented people that were in the cast went on to do other things. Al Franken. The last season of the show that I was on, Kevin Nealon had been the update anchor and was going to leave as anchor next season. So the spot was open, and it was something I'd always wanted to do, so we had sort of a test. And I did it, and Norm MacDonald did it, and it got sent out to Ohlmeyer. And this is something I'd always wanted. So Lorne and Jim take me out to dinner to give me the bad news, right? I know that's what the dinner is about, but neither of them can kind of get up the courage to tell me. So we're eating dinner, we're talking about everything else. We go through the appetizer, the entree, it's a nice dinner at a nice Italian restaurant, some place downtown. Finally, we get to dessert and coffee, and we're having our coffee, and I go like, guys, what's going on with the update thing? It's Ohlmeyer, it's Ohlmeyer. And I go, well, okay. But I'm heartbroken, and now I know I'm leaving the show. It's this big blow to me. And then the check comes, and neither Lorne nor Jim has brought their credit cards, so I have to pay for the dinner. But I got reimbursed. It has a happy ending. Lorne Michaels. The writing was on the wall with Al when he didn't get update and Norm MacDonald did, which was a very tough decision. I think there was a feeling at that moment, from Ohlmeyer in particular, that Al was too associated with the show, the old show. Norm MacDonald. Adam Sandler liked me, and he told Jim Downey about me, and then Jim Downey said I could come on the show. I wanted to be a writer and performer. I wasn't a very good writer, and I wasn't a very good performer, but I could be a writer-performer. And the one place I could do that was SNL, because Lorne was always good with letting writers perform if they were funny. I always thought Chevy was the best guy at doing update. Most people were not good at it, you know? So I didn't think if I was bad I'd be singled out. Just basically Chevy and Dennis Miller were the only good ones ever. So I wasn't worried about it. James Downey. Most of my friends liked the Norm update. They thought it was better than previous incarnations of Update. They liked the way we did it. Deadpan, just very straight, no frills, and the jokes were smart. And they would say it was the reason they watched the show or the best thing in the show. The prevailing attitude at the show and at the network was that Update was the problem of the show. And I know Lorne felt it was really hurting the show. He would never say it to me directly. When we brought Norm in, Herb was still in charge of it, but because Norm was my protege, I had for the first time a lot of influence, and then I brought other people in. So Update was suddenly being group-written again. A lot of writers would kick in things. We liked writing stuff for Norm because he was great at handling words. He worked with us at editing things down so they could be as tight as possible.
Janine Garofalo. I certainly am a big fan of Jim Downey as a person. I really like Jim. But he was not in control when I was there, when he should have been. He should have been looking out for some of the cast's best interests, too, and he wasn't. And he was not available for meetings. He is a great guy and an extremely funny guy, and as a person, I would hang out with Jim Downey any time. But at that time, he was not there for the cast.
Norm MacDonald. Jim Downey is the best. He was producer the first year I did Update, and then after that he got fired as producer and I got him just to do Update, which was good for me because I got to work with him full time and he was great. He was a brilliant guy. He was the funniest guy there and the smartest. He would work as sort of like a great editor. You know, he would take the jokes and figure out ways to sharpen them and improve them and, you know, narrow them and stuff like that. And he knew about politics, which I had no interest in at all. So he could think politically and stuff. James Downey. There'd be some giant hack joke that you knew would destroy, but it would be an embarrassing thing to do. And I could always say to Norm, "This thing will kill, but you know it's tacky." And he would not do it. Or I would say, "This is brilliant, but there's not a chance it'll get a laugh from the audience." And we would do those. Adam Sandler. Downey taught us our taste. I'm not sure if Jim would like that, all the bad reviews I get, but I think I'm doing stuff that Downey would like. But if Herlihy and I wrote a skit, and we showed it to Downey, and he smiled and then said, "What if the canteen boy says this?" me and Herlihy would bump chests and go, "Yes, Downey gave us greatness." Fred Wolfe. After Chris Rock left the show, he came back like 6 or 7 months later to visit. And my office, at that time, it was me, Norm MacDonald, Adam Sandler, and David Spade. And we were back there, and Chris Rock came to visit all of us. And he said he's been out there in the world, doing some other shows, doing some other comedies, and doing some movies, and working with In Living Color, and all this sort of stuff. And he said that it's really great, but the one thing that he has recognized is that there is no one like Jim Downey out there. And that was a sad thing. David Mandel. Some of the greatest jokes that were ever added to other writers' sketches at the table came from Jim Downey. So even in something he didn't necessarily write, I can't explain it except to say he impacted everything that went through. And this is not to take anything away from the current people at Saturday Night Live, who I think are great. But I've sat through the way they rewrite, and they rewrite relatively quickly. And you just know they don't stay until 5 in the morning. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not sure it was great that we stayed until 5 in the morning. But Jim Downey added things to sketches that no other human being could, and I've seen Jim, like, dictate a sketch from his head as if it must be like the way genius chess players see chess. It's almost as if he's reading from a script in his head that the rest of us can't see, and he's trying to read and dictate it. I sat in a room with him once when John Malkovich hosted. We did a Menendez Brothers sketch, if you can remember, where Rob Schneider and John Malkovich played the brothers, and their testimony was that there were two other Menendez brothers, their twin brothers, who were responsible for the killing and were waiting in the bathroom. And then they would get up and go get the other Menendez brothers and come in. They would switch sides and sit down and pretend to be two other Menendez brothers. They would then be asked where the first two Menendez brothers were and be told that they were in the bathroom. And this kept going on until then one left and never came back. I sat in the room at like 6 in the morning with Jim lying on a couch, and basically a couple of us got a few jokes in, but this came fully formed out of Jim's head. And to this day I've never seen anything like that. James Downey. That summer I never heard from Lorne or anybody from the date of the last show in May of 1995. The phone never rang, which I thought was kind of insulting. Finally Dana called me and said, "I can't believe those fucking assholes haven't even talked to you." And he said, "Do you want to come to work for my show?" I said, "That's very nice of you." And then like 5 minutes later, Mike Shoemaker called them, and then Lorne got on the phone and said, "Hey, you want to write for the show?" And that's when I said I would only do it if I could just do Update. In the same years that he was getting the most grief from network executives that he'd ever received in his career, Lorne Michaels also got an exquisitely flattering offer. Howard Stringer, the CBS president who had lured David Letterman to the network partly by buying Letterman the Ed Sullivan Theater and the office building above it, offered to do the same for Michaels. A great admirer, Stringer thought Michaels could put CBS in the Saturday late-night business the way Letterman had put CBS in the late weeknight business for the first time in its history. He had a mock-up photo made of the Lorne Michaels Theater to tempt him. But Michaels, even though under siege, really a constant barrage, turned Stringer down. He still felt a loyalty, if not to NBC, then to the show he had created. Chris Rock. Was being on the show the greatest creative experience for me? No. But it's still the biggest thing that ever happened to me in show business. The jump from broke to famous is the biggest jump. There's no bigger jump than that. I could win 5 Oscars tomorrow. It wouldn't be a bigger jump than nothing to something. Is Lorne arrogant? Yeah, but hey, man, I know arrogant cab drivers. I know arrogant hot dog guys. This guy produces Saturday Night Live. He made The Ruddles, one of my favorites. So, you know, there's arrogance with no reason to be, and there's arrogance with plenty of reason to be. Tim Meadows. Lorne wrote me a couple of cold openings. Lorne can still write, you know. I guess he prefers not to, but he can. I forgot that he can write. I didn't know that he was such a great writer. But then people mention names like Lily Tomlin and the Smothers Brothers. It's obvious that he knows what he's doing.
Julia Sweeney. I think Lorne is a withholder of praise as a strategy, and also because I think he personally feels uncomfortable with it. I remember him stopping me in the hallway and just saying, "I think you're wonderful." It's not like he didn't give me anything. It was more like an aura. It's like in the air. It makes me understand cults, because you just wanted his approval more, and that was your number one thing. You wanted him to approve of you, and he created an atmosphere that worked with that.
Lorne Michaels. My bet is that Johnny and Ed don't hang together so much now. I could be wrong. I used to say that you get only so many hours that you can be with someone in a lifetime, and you can kind of use it all up in a very intense 4 or 5 years, or you can spread it over a lifetime. Friendship really needs distance and space. Not that we're overcrowding like rats, but the schedule is built so that after 3 shows in a row, when people are really getting on each other's nerves, there's a hiatus, and you get some distance on it, and you appreciate what a good place it is to work. Early in the 90s, NBC West Coast president Don Olmeyer and other executives had begun taking a more aggressive interest in the show, concerned about ratings and giving Michaels lots of unsolicited advice on such matters as who was funny, who wasn't, who should be fired, and suggesting innumerable cosmetic changes. From the beginning, Michaels had resisted NBC's attempts to use the show as a promotional tool, balking, for example, when the network implored him to book Eric Estrada, the star of NBC's Chips, as a host. Olmeyer, whom Ebersol had tried to hire to direct Saturday Night Live back in the formative days, thought superstars Adam Sandler and Chris Farley were among those who should go. He didn't get them and told Michaels they should be fired. NBC brass said the show had grown too costly and accused Michaels, in effect, of coasting. Olmeyer even said he thought Michaels spent too much time on the beach at St. Bart's, one of his repertory of longtime haunts, and not enough time streamlining the show. Michaels theorized that one reason for the executives' greater interest in the show was that they felt emboldened by the success they had with Friends in prime time. Network executives gave themselves credit for putting that ensemble together and then wanted to take a stab at casting Saturday Night Live, too. An executive with delusions of creativity, like a wounded pig, is a dangerous animal. The show suffered a run of bad luck and bad timing. Dana Carvey's departure at the end of the 1992-93 season had been particularly crucial because he took such a large collection of characters and impressions with him. He was a whole stock company himself. Phil Hartman left a year later and gave interviews in which he made nasty cracks about the quality of the show's writing, even though he'd thrived in sketch after sketch. Rather suddenly and concurrently, the press turned hostile, dredging up the old Saturday Night Dead slurs to say the show was stale, and giving SNL a relentless trouncing even when the cast was still stellar. Michaels experienced the worst reviews of his career and found some of the attacks distressingly and discouragingly personal. One reviewer wrote that the show had been a lifeless, humorless corpse for 2 years, and now it's starting to stink. Others were similarly hostile, if not quite so inelegant. Saturday Night Live is showing its age. About as amusing as a state funeral. The show needs a kick in the pants. Nobody's laughing anymore. You watch it now and sullenly stare at the television. In addition to all that, there was dissent from within. Crabby campers who joined the cast and almost immediately developed grievances and complaints. If Saturday Night Live was in yet another transitional phase, these particular growing pains were agonizing, and the more injured the show looked, the more network honchos stepped up their attack, even to the point of leaking to reporters that nothing about Saturday Night Live was sacrosanct or untouchable, Lorne Michaels pointedly included. Michaels may have begun to look back fondly even at 1985, the low-rated year he returned as executive producer. It probably looked good compared to 1994. For him, the worst year in the show's history. For the moment, the fashionable thing was to knock Saturday Night Live. The sport became so popular that even certain members of the cast joined in. Lorne Michaels. Phil Hartman was here 8 years. After most shows, he and I would sit together at the party, and there was just a sort of comfort level between the two of us. We obviously loved each other. And when Phil left, the separation was a hard and difficult thing. And then he gave some interview bad-mouthing the next cast. And he didn't like Sandler or whatever, and then he went after me. And I went, "Phil? But I think it's how people separate. You suddenly get out of bed and you go, 'I didn't like this, I didn't like that.' There isn't anyone here who week after week doesn't build their case on how unfairly they've been treated. I think it's the most natural thing because they don't have power over their own lives. They submit a piece, and once they've reached some level of fame, the whole world is telling them how good they are. But around here, they're dealing with the fact that the writers didn't write anything for them that week, the fact that the writers got up in the morning thinking about themselves and not about them, the fact that the writers sometimes look as if they have more say about things than they do, and the fact that a piece they thought went very well in dress got cut. Just being one of 8 or 10 or whatever is really hard after a while. For most of us in the beginning, and I think it's true to this day, their office is nicer than their apartment, and so just about everything in the way they live becomes an improvement once they get here. And then I think a lot of people come here and it's their first job, and then within weeks they have an agent, a manager, a publicist, a lawyer, a business manager. And it validates they're actually in show business, because they're talking to people about their career all the time. And after a while, there's not enough money to be made just being here. There's more money to be made by the people who influence them. My job is to hold it together. I hate giving up people, I just do. At the same time, whenever we've gone through big change, it's always been kind of intoxicating, and it's kind of what makes the show. If I were still doing the show with the 70s group, I think we'd just all be fried. Al Franken. I remember getting a call from someone at the Philadelphia Inquirer. "Why doesn't the show take chances?" And I said, "Why don't we take chances? I think we do." And she said, "I'm talking about risky stuff, like, you know how Letterman does the monkey cam? Now that's risky." And I go, "Okay, that's not risky. It's just a great idea. It's not a risky idea. You put a camera on a monkey's head and the monkey runs around the studio. It's great. But you don't know what the word risky means, lady. James Downey. I do think the network stepped all over Leno, who they micromanaged to a crazy degree. They basically tried as much as they possibly could to make his show like Saturday Night Live. I remember at one point they asked us, "Do you guys have a problem if Phil Hartman is like Jay's sidekick? Can he do Clinton or Gorbachev or something?" And I remember going, "Actually, yeah, we do. He's in our cast, and if you've seen him three nights or even two nights, it just makes it that much less special." I remember being mad. I always felt that performers who weren't stand-ups, but the type who were very much dependent on writing, really should run stuff by us, because they really are representing the show. The only reason Phil could walk on Leno as Bill Clinton without any explanation is that he did Clinton on Saturday Night Live. Once you're in that situation, if it's not well-written or if it's offensive or stupid or otherwise problematic, it hurts us. It's the reason Disney doesn't let people dress up as Mickey Mouse and do car shows and stuff. I think Lorne did say, "No, you can't do that." Lorne did object to that stuff, but they were very aggressive about it. They sort of looked to the show for ideas like we were a chop shop or something. Like, "Hey, we saw you do that thing. That's good. Jay could do that." I guess they felt like, "We might need to borrow some things from you guys to really nail down Jay's emerging superiority." Robert Wright. Quite frankly, the show is always in a period where people are saying, "Oh my God, what are we going to do? The cast is not going to be here next year or the year after. What are we going to do?" I've gone through at least three or four of those since I've been here. The worst one was when Don decided he was going to take a big position on the show. I didn't know about it in advance. What happened is those non-aggression pacts that Lorne had signed were wearing thin, and Don was not willing to be a bystander on SNL. Don also didn't travel, so he wouldn't come to New York except under extreme circumstances, and he liked to see his producers in person. He's a very across-the-table kind of guy. And Lorne wasn't out there that much and wasn't interested in having long sessions with Don about details of the show. And I think, quite frankly, initially Don was less interested in the talent than he was about the fact that the show wasn't as profitable as he had thought it would be. He thought it could be fixed rather easily, that the show should be and could be a great deal more profitable for NBC. He'd been led to believe that by some of the finance people and some of the other production people on the West Coast. There's always a West Coast, East Coast angle on these sorts of things. He was sending sort of coded messages to Lorne about this, that, and the other thing, and Lorne was doing his own dance around those issues. It was either, "Didn't know that, I'll get on it," or, "He's not available, he's gone to Hungary, won't be back for 3 months." And I think Don just made it a point of writing down every day, "I'm going to catch him on this. We're going to get this done." Warren Littlefield. We felt that Lorne was isolating himself, and we were looking at a new generation of writer-producer talent that had come up with a show like Seinfeld. They hadn't been grown and nurtured in comedy camp. They hadn't worked on Different Strokes and then done Seinfeld. These were original voices. We would suggest names and people to Lorne. We didn't know how open he was. Our intent was not to take it away from Lorne. Our intent was to be able to say to Lorne, "Look, they're out there. Their lifelong dream would be to go to New York and work on SNL. Maybe you've got to start looking at some of these other kinds of people." Believe me, these were not prime-time situation comedy. They were alternative, unique voices who had put their toe in the water of television and hadn't found out quite what their outlet was. I think Don was much more focused on, "There's so much wrong." And so those were very, very tough sessions with Lorne. Ultimately, what emerged was what we wanted to emerge. Lorne engaged more actively, more time and more energy, a more aggressive pursuit of reinventing the show. I don't think Lorne surrendered control. I think he surrendered to a process that was painful. We were able to keep the show running, and the market turned around, and it became a profitable entity again. It became an asset, not only creatively, but it also became a financial asset as well. Nothing wrong with that. Lorne Michaels. The network was, on a certain level, completely justified in saying, "We're cleaning house," because you couldn't read anywhere anybody saying, Saturday Night Live is doing what it's supposed to be doing, or these people are funny. We had to let Adam Sandler go with 2 years on his contract, and Farley with a year. Chris Rock had gone on to In Living Color. Spade was allowed to come back in a sort of David Spade moment kind of thing. But it was basically, you know, you pull away to turn this all around and just say, here we are with a brand new cast. And Downey couldn't be producer. Downey couldn't be here. And even Herb Sargent was let go. It was just everybody was let go. Adam Sandler. The guys at SNL protected me a lot. They didn't tell me much. I really didn't even know who Ohlmeyer was. I never met him, I don't think. I just felt if Lorne likes me and if Downey likes me, I'm safe. And then I heard at the end that Lorne was having to fight for me to be on the show. This is what Sandy, my manager, would tell me, that NBC wasn't happy with me. And I'd say, what's Lorne think? Oh, Lorne's happy with you. And I said, okay, all right, then we're all set then, right? And I think at the time Lorne was catching a little bit of flack from them, so he had to listen more than he had in the past. See, I don't even know if I was fired. I don't know how it was handled. I just remember feeling like, did I quit or did I get fired? I have no idea. But all of a sudden I wasn't on the show anymore. But I was friends with everyone at Saturday Night Live still. That's all that counted to me. I never had a tight relationship with NBC. The guys who were important to me were Lorne and Downey and Smigel, of course Herlihy, who is an amazing guy, and a couple of the other writers. It really was, creatively, the best time of my life. I'm honored to be a member of that bunch of alumni, and I have my best friends from that show. It does feel like we went to war together, even though it was a positive thing. Nobody was scared for their lives, but we stuck it out together, and every Saturday night people were tuning in to laugh, and we wanted to make sure that we got the job done. And we all have a nice bond together. Don Ohlmeyer, NBC executive. Well, I got into it very straightforward with Lorne. I mean, it's not really my job to talk to Jim Downey. Actually, we would meet twice a year, and like I said, I was very straightforward. I think people pretty much knew where they stood with me in terms of what I felt. I wasn't one of those kind of people that would glad-hand people and then talk behind their backs. I think Jim Downey is maybe as good a political satirist, writer, as there's ever been in television. I think when Jim was the head writer, there were some issues on the show. When you have the talent that was assembled during that period and the shows were as flat as they were, there's some issues somewhere. That was just my perception. Warren Littlefield. There was one old writer. Oh yeah, Jim Downey. Jim's brilliant. He had a wonderful, wonderful career. But Jim, I think some would say, was a little burnt out. He'd done it for a long time. And so finally for Ohlmeyer it became, you know what? We will not accept anything less than excellence. James Downey. I've only met Ohlmeyer 3 times. He'd been just relentlessly trying to get me fired for like 9 months before he ever laid eyes on me. He had this theory that the problem was the show was flat, because we'd come off this gigantic ratings year, 92-93, which had to do with Wayne's World. I thought, and most of the writers there thought, the show was clearly in decline. There was like a 3-year lag between the ratings we got and the ratings we deserved. We thought it was more 89-90 that the show was creatively better, and that by 1993 we were sort of coasting. We averaged like a 9.5 rating with the Wayne's World heat. We haven't seen that in many, many years. My marriage was falling apart because I was spending way too much time at the show. I remember thinking it's not worth it to do anything embarrassing to keep this job. So I'm not going out of my way to antagonize them, but I'm not going to kiss their ass. Because I could come home and say, honey, I was fired. But I could not come home and say, honey, I quit. Aren't you proud of me? Now I have to find a new job. So that was the idea. Norm MacDonald. I think Lorne even conceded that changes needed to be made and decided to overhaul. But I think also that nobody liked Jim at the network at that time. He's not a very savvy office politician when it comes to talking to people or anything. He's more like an artist guy who wants to be left alone. He's really into comedy, so he's not that good with the suits. James Downey. With the arrival of Ohlmeyer and then NBC doing so well, The basic personality of the network became more aggressive and confident and notey. They were feeling their oats. They used to talk about Friends and often contrast Friends to Seinfeld by saying, "We cast Friends," the implication being that's why the people were more attractive. So they were very confident. It used to be that they would not offer anything except, "My God, you guys are great, and we're not here to tell you your job." And then it became, "Just for what it's worth, we loved that, just great." And then it became, "I don't know that this works." And it finally reached a point where it became, "We don't care that it's popular. We don't want you doing this because we don't like it." That's not even a business value. They were so at peace with their own taste and worldview that they were willing to take an economic hit just to have something enacted. That reached its peak, I would say, in the 94-95 period. One of the network's ideas that they were very serious about was, why does it have to be live? And why do you need a guest host when it's the cast that brings the people back each week? And they bitched about how the live element made it much more expensive and complicated, and how you could go shoot all your Jeopardy sketches in one afternoon. Lorne Michaels. When it all hit, my son Eddie had just been born, and there were some complications. It turned out to be nothing, but there was a day and a half or 2 days of concern. Alice gave birth to him at 12:30, I think, in the afternoon, and I still managed to make read-through back at 30 Rock. We had made elaborate preparations in case I couldn't be there, altering the chain of command and all that stuff. But I got back to the office, and it was the week Sarah Jessica Parker hosted, and it was just around the time that we were just being hounded everywhere. I don't think I'd ever been as scared. You know, I was never scared in the 70s, I think because I was single then. I had already been through rough periods in my life, and there was nothing really that was going to scare me. I mean, so what would happen? I would be broke and washed up, and I'd already had that a couple of times. Don Ohlmeyer. Lorne and I used to have long, involved conversations, almost psychoanalytical, about the problems. Sometimes identifying the problems is the most difficult thing. It's very subjective. I would certainly never presume that I know more about doing Saturday Night Live than Lorne. I can watch the show and react as a viewer, or I can watch the show and react as somebody who is running the operation and has a vested interest in the success of the show. I can look at the numbers, I can do all these different things, but if you're not there on a day-to-day basis, you don't really know what the problem is. Lorne knew that there was a problem, but I think he was unsure of exactly what the problem was. Objectively, Lorne knew the show could be better. You had to look at what are the strengths and weaknesses of the cast, even though they're very talented. Do we need some fresh blood? Do we need a fresh approach in the writing? Ultimatum is a difficult word. No, I never gave Lorne an ultimatum. But what I basically said to him is, the show has to get better.